dissatisfaction with the government of the Northwest Territories as it's presently structured. This is an area one-third the size of Canada. It's an area that includes peoples and histories that are vastly different, and we believe contain such diversity as to be really ungovernable. It is particularly absurd that the Northwest to us from the Eastern Arctic, that the Northwest Territory should be governed from a capital in a southwestern portion of this vast area, three time zones away and light years away in understanding and experience in the views of many of our people. However, we believe that the model of a territorial form of government is a good base for negotiating a new government in the eastern part of the Northwest Territories. We are confident that with Nunavut, we can profit from the powers and even from the advances in recent years made by the government of the Northwest Territories in expanding its jurisdiction. And I'd just like to, by making reference to the annual report index, just list the powers that are presently enjoyed by the territorial form of government. And I think they're not insignificant, at least as a start. Justice, status of women, finance, personnel, economic development and tourism, public works, renewable resources, that includes all the land, jurisdiction over all the land mammals in the Northwest Territories, energy, mines and resources, although we don't have nearly the powers that we'd like to have in that area yet, education, same jurisdiction as a province, social services, health, local government, and Aboriginal rights and constitutional development. I'd also like to dispel the idea that the territorial form of government is a puppet of the federal government, which is really run by a federally appointed commissioner. Although we have a titular head of government in this person who's called the commissioner, in my view, the commissioner of the Northwest Territories, and probably with his full support, is merely a few steps away from being a lieutenant governor or a truly symbolic titular federal representative in the territories. We have very determinedly and I think successfully eroded the powers of the federal government through the commissioner over the Northwest Territories in recent years. Just last fall, we succeeded in getting the federal government to agree to eliminate the deputy commissioner's position. He was, until then, a voting member of the Executive Council, really a member of the cabinet, and a federal civil servant. That position no longer exists, and we have also in the last 4 years been able to strip the commissioner and the deputy commissioner of all their departmental responsibilities except one, which is the Department of Personnel, which I believe will soon be replaced by a public service commission. So all the important departments of government are now run by elected ministers. And we fully expect that the Nunavut Territory will take up where this political evolution has left off. Mr. Chairman, I would like to briefly describe the Nunavut proposal But first I should just explain that the booklet, Building Nunavut, which is available, and I believe most participants here would have, gives a fairly exhaustive description of precisely what powers we propose for the Nunavut government. I'd like to just touch on some of the main features and conclude my presentation. As mentioned earlier, we are proposing a public form of government. It will have a very high native majority in its early years, and something around 85% to 90% of the population of Nunavut, depending on where the boundary goes, will be Inuit people. So they will have a very firm control over the new government, at least for the foreseeable future. One safeguard that we wish to include to avoid large numbers of transients taking over the government without having at least resided significant period of time in the new territory will be a voting requirement, a residency requirement. The Canadian Constitution, the new Canadian Constitution, may well prevent us from imposing as sizable a residency requirement as we'd like, but we're hoping, I think, that it would be at least 3 years, as was required in the plebiscite vote. The other thing I should point out early on is that the Nunavut Constitutional Forum, which has been described earlier, feels very strongly that the Constitution must be built at the community level with full participation of the residents of the proposed new territory. And I would like to make it very clear that we have completed over 30 very extensive community hearings already in three vast regions of the Eastern Arctic, and we're about to continue with further extensive hearings the week after next in the Western Arctic, in the area of the Inuvialuit, the purpose being to get grassroots input and advice on the Constitution. And we are also going to host a constitutional convention at the end of this process, whereby we will seek, with representatives from every community, ratification of the proposed form of government before we go ahead and negotiate with the federal government to implement Nunavut. One other thing I'd like to say is that an advantage of the territorial form of government is that it can be created by an act of the federal parliament without concurrence of or interference from the provinces. And we see this as a very distinct advantage in pursuing our constitutional goals. The creation of a province, which is our goal, is more complicated and will require, unless the Constitution is amended, will require approval from other provinces in Canada. But we want to take things a step at a time and seek a territorial status and build our strength and begin our further negotiations from there. A few of the issues that have been raised in the communities that are not really covered in this document are the importance of the role of elders, those who transmit the values and culture of the people. And we are being pressed by communities to find some means of allowing elders to participate, perhaps some kind of a senate, although I don't think the senate that we would propose would have the legislative veto powers as the same legislative veto powers as the senate, as I understand it, which was proposed in the Denendeh proposal. But we are looking for some model of allowing elders to advise the government of Nunavut. And we are also being pressed very strongly by the communities to give even stronger emphasis to the incorporation of customary law and traditional methods of dispute resolution to build those into the constitution of Nunavut. An important feature I should mention, Mr. Chairman, is that we have determined that it is necessary to entrench a Bill of Rights in order to protect visibly the rights of minorities. We wish to ensure that individuals of all cultures and races are free to fulfill themselves in Nunavut. It may be that indeed this Bill of Rights might eventually need to be used to protect the interests of a native minority, if that should ever occur in Nunavut. Sea mammals are extremely important to the Inuit. And sea mammals and most development activities in the Northwest Territories are presently federal responsibilities and beyond any significant control of our territorial form of government. I include land use and ownership, mining, oil and gas development, shipping, and ice breaking. A major concern of Aboriginal peoples in the Northwest Territories, indeed all people in the Northwest Territories, is that the federal government's policies are unresponsive to northern preferences and are shaping the North irrevocably. We recommend that territorial governments, the present Northwest Territorial government or a future Nunavut government, have a much larger role in policy making in such cases as and such matters as marine management. The Inuit in particular are deeply concerned that the Canadian federal authorities are not managing affairs as actively as they should. We are also very concerned about having impact into the major source of development in activity in the Northwest Territories, the non-renewable sector. We have accepted, I think, realistically, that it is not going to be possible to displace the federal government completely in the predominant role it shares in most forms of development. But we propose that the Nunavut government share in the effort, and in relation to the offshore, as well as decisions respecting offshore development, we have proposed that something like the Canada-Nova Scotia offshore agreement be explored, where there would be a shared role in management and a shared revenues from those resources accruing to the territory. We also propose that we should build on the increased responsibilities that the Northwest Territories government has obtained in mining. We know that the Northwest Territories government has jurisdiction to regulate mining safety in the Northwest Territories. We propose that we should be given total jurisdiction over the mining activity in the Northwest Territories, again, with a share in resource revenues. A few other features of the new government I would just like to touch on are that the Native Language Institute would become an official language, a working language of the government of the Northwest Territories, the government of Nunavut. We would seek to expand on the communications systems that are now in place in the eastern part of the Northwest Territories, television and radio, and see those systems become even more active as a means of bridging the formidable geographic and climatic barriers between our communities. We have addressed and expressed great concern about an issue we call cultural property, which is what Mr. O'Neill was referring to this morning. You'll see there's an important section in our proposal calling for protection of artifacts and archaeological sites which have been robbed in our history. We also would seek to build up improved relations between circumpolar countries and jurisdictions. Greenland, Alaska, Northern Quebec. Another aspect that emerged very strongly in our hearings was the need to focus a tremendous effort on education and training for Aboriginal peoples in the eastern part of the Northwest Territories. It was driven home to us very strongly in the community hearings that we should make education and training a priority if we are to avoid making the same mistake over again in creating a government in the Eastern Arctic which will be dependent on outsiders in large measure for key administrative and bureaucratic positions. The final point I'd like to make, Mr. Chairman, is that the Nunavut proposal recognizes, after a number of studies that we've done, and perhaps I should just mention some of the studies that that we have initiated and completed. Division of powers between Nunavut and Ottawa, financial perspectives, which examine the nature and flexibilities and possibilities of the Canadian federal system in accommodating the needs of Nunavut and its overwhelmingly Inuit population. We've also done studies on Inuit customary law, statutory language guarantees, preamble to the Nunavut Constitution, a Nunavut Bill of Rights, and special measures relating to the offshore. The study on the division of powers in Canadian Confederation and the study on financial perspectives revealed to us that, contrary to popular conception, the Canadian Constitution isn't rigid in dividing powers between federal and provincial jurisdictions. There are an infinite number of possibilities for the acquisition of power and control over one's destiny within Confederation. Section 91 and Section 92 are nowhere near as rigid as they might seem to be, and the possibilities of management agreements, delegation, contracts, and other innovative means of accommodating our unique needs in the Eastern Arctic are wide open to us with enough hard work and negotiation. So we are confident that there are ways in which our interests can be protected. But we'll start off with the territorial form of government, building on the progress that's been made by the Territorial Legislative Assembly in recent years, and getting as much as we can when Nunavut is established with the passage of a bill in the House of Commons, but then using that new government as a basis for developing even more powers and more self-determination, which we see as quite possible within the Canadian Confederation. The First Minister's Conference defining Aboriginal rights in the Constitution is a matter of great interest to us. We're ultimately hoping that the form of self-government which we will obtain, we're confident, in Nunavut, will be given some kind of constitutional recognition and protection through entrenched provisions respecting self-government or respecting Nunavut. And we're also hoping that the constitutional amendment process will eliminate some very serious barriers that we see to establishing provincehood, namely the requirement of approval of 7 out of 10 provinces for the establishment of a new province with over 50% of the population, which we think is a hurdle that none of the other provinces had to overcome when they were established, and it's not fair to impose it on us. And secondly, the very iniquitous provision which allows at the moment those same 7 provinces to agree to extend their boundaries north into the Northwest Territories. That will, if such a move were ever to take place, that would probably result in anger and militancy such as has never been heard before in the North. We're confident that with the attention that the Northwest Territories and the Union Committee on National Issues have been getting in the First Minister's Conference and the credibility with the fairly reasonable approach that's been taken, that we can persuade the provinces to remove these iniquitous provisions. One final point I'd just like to touch on. We were asked in preparing this presentation just how the Alaskan experience had influenced us. And I'd like to say that, or echo what Mr. Itinuar said, that in developing our form of government in the Eastern Arctic, we probably didn't advert very directly to the Alaskan experience, but I think it's very clear from what Mark Gordon said that Alaska was a strong influence on the Quebec and James Bay Agreement, and therefore indirectly has had a very strong influence on us, because of course the Quebec and James Bay Agreement set the tone for land claims in Canada. The only thing I would like to observe is that we are beginning to see, I believe, in northern Canada, some of the stresses that have been adverted to in your hearings so far between expectations of native corporations to make profits and the expectations of people in the communities that these corporations should also be the means of protection of the long-term interests of native people. We are seeing the beginnings of those kinds of conflicts and stresses in Canada with respect to certain native development corporations, and I'm very hopeful that we may learn some lessons from the experience in Alaska in dealing with those problems, and perhaps finding ways of making sure that native corporations are accountable to their constituents and operate as democratically as is possible for profit-making corporations. We're very much looking forward to hearing any recommendations that your commission might make on that particular problem, because we see, I see the same tensions emerging or beginning in northern Canada. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and I know on behalf of all the Canadians here, we're very pleased that we had the opportunity to participate in this most informative session. And I'll pass the microphone to Mr. Ames on behalf of Tumavik Federation. I think he's going to, I've asked him to emphasize to what extent the Tumavik claim also pursues political rights and political development issues. Although it's very clear that the government of Canada has tried to separate political development from land claims, we have not been willing to put all our eggs in one basket. And I think Mr. Ames is going to explain that despite the federal claims policy, the Inuit have made some progress in the other front, land claims negotiation, in obtaining some measure of political rights in addition to what we're doing in the Nunavut Forum. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Ames.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As mentioned earlier by Mr. Tinawar, I'm part of the research negotiating team for the Tumavik Federation of Nunavut. The TFN represents some 15,000 Inuit living north and east of the tree line. I should make it clear at the outset, I'm going to use the word Nunavut quite often, and in the context that I'm using it in, it's in a land claims context. We also use the term Nunavut to refer to our area of claim, and it's not to be confused with the larger political context in which COPE is part of the Nunavut territory. The mandate of the TFN is the settlement of land claims. It's a comprehensive land claims package covering an enormous area of the Arctic. There's about 4,000 years of occupation and use in that area. The archaeological record distinguishes between four levels or four cultures that have evolved over time. The Inuit in prehistoric times were primarily an isolated group of people with little contact with the outside world. Certainly there was sporadic contact with their neighbors to the south, the Indians. Sometimes the relations were less than cordial, but the next period of contact came with the whalers and the early explorers. The periods of contact vary tremendously depending on part of the Arctic that people are in. The earliest contact periods were in the eastern Arctic, and this continued over a period of years, right into the 20th century, with the fur trade, the missionization, the RCMP, right up until the 1950s and 1960s, when the federal government decided that people should be brought in off the land and brought into settlements, primarily for the purpose of health and education, but also for reasons of ease of administration. In 1971, Inuit Pearcet of Canada was formed in response to pressures on Inuit people in the north. People were quite concerned that their culture was being eroded, that they had a number of goals and aspirations that could not be met through the current government system. In 1973, there was the Supreme Court case decision in British Columbia concerning the Nishka, which in many ways prompted Inuit to begin a land claim settlement in the Northwest Territories. And what came out of that was, between 74 and 76, a comprehensive land use and occupancy study, which enabled people to document their areas of use and occupation. In 1976, the Inuit submitted a Nunavut proposal, as it was called, to the federal government, which was accepted by the federal government. It included land claims and political aspirations. However, the 76 proposal, people felt at the time, was a very complex thing, and there hadn't been enough consultation with the communities, so it was withdrawn. A land claims commission was formed. This was under Inuit Tapirisit of Canada, which negotiated for about a year and a half with the federal government. The commission was not successful in getting any agreements with the federal government. However, it was successful in delivering the message that Inuit were not prepared to settle land claims without some kind of political development. They were not going to settle unless their political aspirations had been met. The commission, however, was dissolved, and a new process of negotiations began. The responsibility for land claims was gradually devolved through another organization, finally to the Tunguvik Federation of Nunavut, which is an independent organization of ITC. However, ITC is the mother from which it came. I've heard a lot of talk about sovereignty over the past couple of days, and currently sovereignty in the true sense of the word, which I think means supreme, absolute, independent, is not really an issue within the claims process. I think Inuit are prepared to settle their needs within the bounds of Confederation, using a Nunavut territory and using the land claims process as the vehicles. When we began thinking about land claims, it was clear most of us were very new at it, and it was a tremendous task to design a comprehensive land claims package. We tried to identify basic goals, basic principles, and I think that the overall thinking was that what we had to do was provide people with a package that gave people rights, that gave people management responsibilities, to put together a package or a settlement that wasn't frozen in time, something that allowed evolution to occur through management, through economics. It wanted to put people on an equal footing with the outside world. And it wanted, I think, to give people freedom of choice in the future. In other words, someone who may wish to hunt, trap, and fish for his living would have that opportunity, whereas someone who would wish to be a 9-to-5er would also have that opportunity. We wanted flexibility, and we wanted something that would provide for people, not just for 20 years, but for 200 years, 1,000 years. When we looked at the requirements of a land claims package, we boiled it down to basically five major areas. There are some other areas, and I'll mention those later. But within each of those areas, there's a number of different elements. And the areas that we thought were the most critical were wildlife, land and resources, offshore, the economic aspects of the package, and social provisions. As I said, it was an enormous task, and I think it was much akin to trying to put together a jigsaw puzzle without the picture on the box to help guide you. But we persevered and have come up with about 11 agreements in principle over the past few years. The first topic we negotiated was wildlife. We thought that this was the most critical topic of negotiation for Inuit. And when we approached the topic, we tried to separate rights and management. We wanted to negotiate rights first, because whatever rights we had when it came to wildlife would clearly color the management responsibilities. I'm giving people here a very pragmatic approach to this subject. It might seem almost clinical, but I'm just trying to give you the thinking behind it. We managed to establish that people had the rights to hunt, trap, and fish over the whole Nunavut territory. I've noted that in other settlements, people have tried to block off areas of land in which there would be exclusive hunting and trapping and fishing by Native people. We didn't find this an appropriate approach for a number of reasons. One, ecologically, it doesn't make a lot of sense. Wildlife moves all over the area. Secondly, if you own land as a, be it surface or surface and subsurface, you have the rights to keep other people off. If people want to come on, you can negotiate some kind of access arrangement. So it wasn't really necessary to set aside kind of hunting preserves in that kind of context. And also, even if you own land in which you can hunt, there are laws of general application that apply, so you can't do exactly what you want anyway. So we didn't think this was an appropriate approach. We wanted to establish the rights to hunt, trap, and fish everywhere. We also argued for exclusivity. It was something that the federal government was not prepared to give. So we tried to get it through another way, and we're in some measure successful. We proposed that there be a harvest study that would identify basic level of need, basically what people were taking. And this was going to be a benchmark by which we would measure allocation and future management decisions. This benchmark wasn't frozen in time. People could take more than that. It shouldn't drop below that unless conservation needs required it. But anyway, above that, there would be other categories of use, dealing with commercial and sport and non-beneficiary use. And the bottom line is that if there's not enough wildlife to go around to meet all needs, people's food needs are met first. We also were successful in meeting exclusivity through another technique, which was called presumption of need. It came to specific wildlife species such as polar bear, muskox, walrus, whales. And what it basically said is that Inuit are presumed to need all of these species that people can take on a basis of conservation. If these species ever took off and they were tremendously abundant and it was possible to open them up for other people to use, then that presumption of need could be rebutted. So basically, we provided for people's basic food needs, and we also achieved some measure of exclusivity with other species. We also tried to get the notion across to government that wildlife is a resource. There seems to be a perception amongst people that don't live from resources, from wildlife resources, that they really are resources. And we tried to treat them in an economic fashion. We got people the rights of first refusal when it came to any sport or commercial operation dealing with wildlife. We also intend in the final agreement to negotiate economic support programs for people that will be hunting. Government tried to initially limit us to traditional species. What they saw were traditional species. We didn't think that that was appropriate because as the economy changes and as people's needs change or wildlife is available or whatever, people have to be able to take what they can get. The fisheries, Department of Fisheries and Oceans wanted to remove all species of any commercial value from our rights to take, and identify things like Arctic cod, Greenland shark, Greenland halibut, so on and so forth, arguing that Inuit didn't take those in the past, therefore they didn't have a right to take them in the future. We suggested to them that trapping, which was just introduced into this century, you couldn't really view as a traditional activity, yet government was prepared to accept it. Commercial fishing, which was introduced in some areas of the Arctic about 20 years ago, really wasn't a commercial activity, but government wasn't prepared to accept it as a commercial activity. It was a contradiction in terms. They'd accept one and not another. So we argued successfully that people should have the rights to hunt, trap, and fish any resource in any area of Nunavut. We also argued successfully that wildlife, the definition of wildlife, should include flora, the plant life. And I'm not sure that other settlements provide for that. It's proven to be a problem for the federal government at this point in time. We also established a board. We wanted a board that had management responsibilities and had decision-making power. We have been advised over and over again that people were not satisfied with advisory bodies. We established a board that had four Inuit and had four government people, federal and territorial. I think it was a useful board because, for one, it involved the primary resource users in the management process and the decision-making process. Secondly, it brought all the managers together so that wildlife could be treated on an ecological basis rather than on a species-by-species basis, as is currently done within the federal government. It was the first time in the territories there was a comprehensive approach to wildlife management. The board was to have responsibilities over many, many areas, including the allocation of resources, research, habitat protection, management and conservation areas, and a number of other areas. It also could make decisions. The decision-making process, and I think this is quite critical because we're having a lot of trouble with the agreement at this point in time, was that the board would make a decision. If it would be sent to the minister responsible, if the minister did not disallow it, it had the effect of law. If the minister was unhappy with the board's decision, he could only do it within particular areas and according to certain criteria, but send the decision back, explaining why. The board was to reconsider it and send it back to the minister. If the minister was not happy with it, it would go to the federal cabinet or it would go to the executive committee if it was a territorial responsibility. Right now, our wildlife agreement, which was negotiated 2 years ago, it was initialed and it was endorsed by the Inuit. It was initialed by the federal government, but it hasn't been endorsed yet. And the kicker is that the federal government does not like to have its hands tied when it comes to decision making. And it's very critical for us at this point in time because as we move into other areas of discussion, we have to have the management responsibility. There's two areas in the wildlife agreement that haven't been, three areas that haven't been negotiated. One are the economic support programs. The second one are the principles of conservation. And these are very critical because the board decisions are based on them. And the principles of conservation have to focus in on the needs of the people as well as on the needs of the resource. You don't draw a line on the map and have a bunch of bambies running around the national park and consider that conservation. That's not meeting the needs of the people. You need, people have to be able to have a healthy resource base in order to make a living. The other area is the harvest study. And this is going to determine, well, we think it should determine two things. One is to identify or document the levels of use right now. But secondly, it has to be used for sound wildlife management. And there's more to wildlife management than counting dead animals. But I think that is what the federal government intends when it comes to the harvest study. All they want to do is document the kill. We think that there should be greater information gathered at that time and it should be combined with economic information in order to ensure that people can use the renewable resource economy as a sound renewable resource economy. As I said, we have problems with our agreement. The federal government came back to us about 3 months ago with 138 changes that they wanted. So far, not a great deal of progress has been made on resolving these issues. The next topic that we got into was land and resources. And we realized, initially we looked at the James Bay Agreement as a model. And we actually designed a James Bay style agreement with community lands and Inuit lands and the balance being in the hands of government. But when we had tried to address the problem of how you select lands, it became a very murky area. Do you select lands for the basis of renewable resources? If you do, what happens when the wildlife leaves the area, as it has a tendency to migrate or change areas over time? Does your land have any value at that time? We also knew the federal government wasn't going to give us very much when it came to subsurface. So we thought that the best way to protect our interests were to get into the whole management package of it and actually suggested to our board that there was really no need to select land if you had proper management responsibilities. Our board, however, felt that there was some need for people to own land, so it was included in the whole land and resource package. Another point about the management is that in order to make the wildlife provisions meaningful, you had to have a sound management system, which involves things like land use planning and impact review. If you don't have something that's legislated, something that you have some kind of confidence in, some certainty to the process, then your wildlife provisions are meaningless. So we designed it was a 240-page document. It took about 8 months to put together. It covered all the management areas, and I'll go through them briefly, and a number of kind of smaller miscellaneous topics, but also fit into the whole land management package. We decided that there had to be a land use planning process, and that there had to be a planning office with plans developed for the whole of the Nunavut region. The planning office would receive applications from developers and would, based on what was designed for the planning in the area, make a decision as to whether this project was appropriate or not. If it was seen to be appropriate, it would go forward to an impact review process. That process would hold public hearings, would review the project, and depending on what the developer's intentions were, and the kinds of terms and conditions that the developer would be prepared to live with, this board would be able to reject or modify or accept the project as it stood. We also thought it would be useful that developers negotiate what we called Inuit impact and benefit agreements as part of any term and condition of development going ahead. And this includes such things as national parks as well as mega projects, oil and gas and mining.